We talk science, politics, and technology today. This morning we sat down with Rick Spinrad. He's the former chief scientist of NOAA and former research director for the U.S. Navy. He's in Honolulu to give a talk today at a seminar at the University of Hawaii as the new head of the Marine Technology Society.
So we are the Marine Technology Society, and it's important to recognize we are an international organization. And it's a professional society of scientists, technologists, and engineers who work in marine and maritime environments. So think about the people who are responsible for ensuring the safety of our ships, the people who are responsible for collecting data and information in the ocean that's then used for things like weather forecasts or surf forecasts or storm forecasts. It includes people who are working on many of the exciting new renewable energy concepts, waves, tides, offshore wind, that kind of thing. The roots of the organization start with the oil and gas industry, largely in the Gulf of Mexico, where roughly 60 years ago, people working in this industry were saying, we need to have a better understanding of how things work in the ocean. It's a dynamic environment. It's a hostile environment when you're putting things in there. And they recognized they needed professional help. So they agreed to organize themselves, like I say, about 60 years ago, to talk about things like how do we ensure the safety of oil rigs? How do we inspect the rigs? What kind of technology? And as a result, the way I like to think of it, the Marine Technology Society is the venue for facilitating both the pull of new technology, what applications like fisheries and oil and gas and national security and commercial shipping are going to draw the need for developing new scientific concepts. And at the same time, we facilitate the push of technology. So if different communities like the information technology community develops new concepts on how to acquire and assimilate data and store data and apply data, or how to build sophisticated computer models, we are there to say, hey, that's a really cool idea. How does it apply to our needs in the marine environment? So it's all things marine. It's focused on science and technology. And like most professional societies, we conduct meetings throughout the year around the world. We have about 2,000 members around the world from about 30 different countries. Many of our members are students, so we work hard to set up student sections. We have local geographic sections, including here in Hawaii, where we've been trying to stimulate even more activity, engage folks even more, and get the word out about what we're doing.
Now, renewable energy is a big deal here in Hawaii, and I know the offshore wind turbines are kind of a novel idea. I think they've got some things going in Europe, maybe something in Atlantic, but nothing in
that's
the
right.
Pacific yet, I think.
That's true. There's a lot of activity in wind and offshore wind throughout. The interesting thing I would say is that when we talk renewables in the marine environment, and especially if you look at the history here in Hawaii, there's been a lot of attention to other kinds of renewable energy. So at Kaneohe, we have the wave energy project that the Navy's been so actively involved in. Off the island of Hawaii, we have had for many, many years the what's called OTEC, the Ocean Thermal Energy Conversion Study, which looks at how can we generate energy by taking advantage of the temperature difference between the surface warm waters and the deep colder waters. So there's a rich legacy in a variety of different way or different renewable energy concepts here in Hawaii, which makes sense given the energy costs here in the state of Hawaii, that this be a good place to develop these new technologies.
And what's your sense as to whether offshore wind is feasible? Because there are a lot of concerns that the military
sure.
has as far as placement of these things.
Exactly. And there's a lot of what's referred to as NIMBY, not in my backyard, concerns. We saw that off the East Coast where there was recognition that there was an abundant supply, if you will, of energy, a lot of wind. And the concern was, how would this affect the environment? How would this affect the aesthetics of the area? So my view is we've got the technology very well in hand. All you have to do is look around the island of Oahu, for example, to see where the wind farms are being placed. You see it on the mainland. So we understand the technology of turbine development and how to make it very efficient. The challenge of putting these systems offshore is not unlike oil and gas, making sure they are safely secured, making sure they don't affect the ecology. How does a wind farm, offshore wind farm, affect migration routes of humpback whales, for example? Those are important questions to ask. And then, of course, the other interesting challenge, I would say, here in Hawaii is that while there is abundant wind, the water gets very deep very quickly. You don't have to go very far offshore before you're in thousands and thousands of feet of water. And so being able to position and locate wind energy devices is going to be a critical consideration in light of the very rapid deepening of the coast here in this state.
And you mentioned the humpback whales, and you have ties to this area in a previous job because you had the hat as the chief scientist for NOAA under the Obama administration. So you're familiar with our waters.
I am. I'm familiar not just with the waters, but with a lot of the land area as well. As you said, I was honored to have been appointed by President Obama to be the chief scientist at NOAA, and in that capacity, we had responsibility for management of all of the National Marine Sanctuaries, including the Humpback Whales National Marine Sanctuary. I can tell you I had the very special honor and treat of being able to swim with the humpbacks a few years ago when I was the head of research at NOAA, all according to regulations.
Yeah,
so I want to make sure listeners recognize there was no harassment of the marine mammals. But you developed such an extraordinary tie to these amazing animals when you're actually able to be with them in their environment. And, of course, those sanctuaries now are even more important in light of impacts of climate change, pollution. The changes that these animals are seeing in their homes, effectively, are very important for us to understand. But I wanted to add, since I said the land area as well, part of my responsibility when I was the head of research at NOAA was to oversee the Mauna Loa Atmospheric Observatory, another jewel in the crown, if you will, of our observational system for understanding atmosphere and what's happening with carbon dioxide in conjunction with climate change.
And so, yeah, Malkuta Mackay, you've got your ties with our area.
Sure. Yeah, this brings us back to the Marine Technology Society. There's some extraordinary engineering capacity here in the state and some really impressive developments. I mean, after all, this is the only state that is a collection of islands, and consequently, attention to and adherence to all the needs for marine technology. It's part of every Hawaiian's life. No matter what they're doing, it impacts what they do.
And we just had an observation conference.
Yes, the Ocean Obs Conference. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had the opportunity to listen to the interview that you did of one of the attendees, a good friend of mine, Chris Sabine. Yes, that's a decadal conference that's done. It's been done in Europe. This was the first time it's been done in the Pacific.
How are you looking at the current climate with NOAA and attempts by this current administration to maybe move in a different direction than, you know, where we were at with the Obama administration?
So the way I look at it, all of this environmental work that's done, not just by NOAA, but let's talk about NOAA, focuses on three real major areas of impact, and I like to characterize it as lives, livelihoods, and quality of life. And what I mean is the really good research that's being done at places like NOAA will affect the safety of people. So a better tsunami forecast, for example, that's the lives part. Livelihoods translates to economic development. So one of the real issues we have here in the state of Hawaii is aquaculture. How much can NOAA's research improve the productivity, the quality of the shrimp and other kinds of foods that are developed through aquaculture and mariculture? That's the livelihoods piece. And then the quality of life is really considering environmental changes and environmental impact. This is a gorgeous state, some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. How do we ensure that it stays that way, that the quality, the water quality, the beach quality is maintained? Coastal resiliency is the catchphrase that we use. How do we ensure that there's no threats, no insults, as we say, to the coastal environment? So where I'm going with this is that I think different administrations emphasize different aspects of that that triad of lives, livelihood, and quality of life. And this current administration is very focused on economic development. And so consequently, I think a lot of the work that's being done at NOAA, we need to think of perhaps a little bit more in terms of the economic development and how it will affect workforce and jobs and growth of the economy, more so than we may have had to focus in other administrations. I'd say more so than we focused when I was there as chief scientist.
What do you think the biggest challenge is going to be when it comes to rolling out some of this new technology and protecting the resource?
I honestly believe the greatest challenge is building awareness on the part of the public writ large, perhaps less so in a state like Hawaii than trying to convince the farmers in Kansas of the impact that they're having on the oceans. But until the public, who basically pays the bills by paying their taxes, recognizes the seriousness and the direct impact of the environment and any changes to the environment, to their lives and livelihood and quality of life, it's always going to be hard to make the compelling argument that this is something we should invest in. And if you look at the history of policy around environment, a lot of times the biggest changes in appropriations, how much money goes into it, or focus, how much attention goes into it, are a consequence of natural disasters or some really significant and really obvious event. A bad hurricane in the southeast raises awareness. Why can't we improve our hurricane forecast capability? Okay, we'll invest some more, and it will take time, and we'll do that. But honestly, I think coming full circle here, what we really need to do is make sure that we engage the public, listen to the public, what they need, what their concerns are, and share the value of what's going on in marine technology and marine research with them. I give a talk to lay audiences on that I call How Oceanography Saved the World. And I feel it's important people recognize that what is done in the ocean, in research and technology, affects each and every one of the global population, but certainly the 330 million Americans.
Now, you know, there's a lot of emphasis now on getting back into space and, you know, pioneering and charting, you know, uncharted areas. We just had a scientist in here last week talking about, you know, how fish mm-hmm. communicate with each other. And, you know, he shared doing that work. You know, he sat under, you know, the bottom of the ocean for 3 hours, basically videotaping and listening to what fish are doing on the reef. And he said it's like being on the moon, exploring the moon, because a lot of it is just uncharted territory. I mean, we just don't know enough about what's happening in our oceans.
So there's, by some estimates, up to 1 million undiscovered species in the ocean. NOAA has a program called the Ocean Exploration Program. They have a dedicated ship, the Okeanos Explorer, whose whole purpose is to explore, go out and look for things. On every cruise that ship undertakes, no matter if it's in the Pacific or in the Atlantic or anywhere else in the world, they make discoveries. Every single cruise, new organisms, new fish. It's not just the, if you will, obscure microorganisms. It's huge, large megafauna. It's fish. It's just about everything you could imagine. The other interesting thing, which is I could argue a bit more practical than the gee whiz aspect of finding new fish and new animals, is that half of the anti-cancer drug discoveries come from marine organisms or marine compounds. Think about that. Half of the anti-cancer drug discoveries, many of which are making it to market now. There's a drug that's being used for treatment of breast cancer that comes from sponges and corals. So consequently, these discoveries have direct implications for the public. And I really am excited about and have a lot of respect for my space scientist colleagues. I would argue that we can see the fruits of our discoveries in the ocean much more immediately. And I'd also argue, and this gets me in trouble with them sometimes, that it's actually much harder to explore in the ocean than it is in deep space because of the constraints of the environment.
I just wonder, maybe you can share, because you were, you know, within NOAA, you know, is there a tension between funding programs, let's say, with climate versus basic marine science?
Not really. I don't see that knockdown, drag-out fight about give me the dollar, no, give me the dollar. But I do think what's happened of late in the last 10 or 20 years is a lot more pressure on the scientific community for accountability. Why should we spend a dollar on space research or underwater research or biomedicine, for that matter, if you can't show me what the end value will be for the public? Is this going to save lives? Is this going to improve the economy? That kind of thing. And so scientists have gotten a lot smarter about figuring that out. What it's also meant is that in fields like marine technology, which are very much physics and math oriented, we've recognized the need to bring in some of the social scientists, people who can look at how economics plays into the equation, or actually behavioral sciences plays into the equation. Think about this. Let's talk about something immediately relevant here in Hawaii, and that's tsunami warnings. So we can get the physicists and mathematicians and computer scientists say, I've built the best model, and I can tell you exactly when that tsunami coming from an earthquake in the West Pacific is going to hit Oahu. But if we don't understand how people will react to the warnings or not react to the warnings, then that scientific, that physical information may not be of value. So we have to ask the behavioral scientists and the economists, how do we translate this physical information into a meaningful understanding for the public?
Right, because you want real-world action, I guess.
Sure.
Otherwise, there's some serious consequences.
And a lot of times, the oceanographers and the meteorologists don't think about how that plays out. I'll give you one specific example we saw in the Midwest, and it was about tornado warnings. So for many, many years, the tornado warning lead time was not very long, just a couple of minutes. And now it's out about 12 minutes, and the meteorologists think we might be able to get that to 15, maybe 20 minutes. And they're saying, wouldn't it be great to get it to 30 minutes? And the behavioral scientists are saying, no, because what happens is at 15 minutes, people say, I better find shelter. I better go collect my kids and make sure we're all safe. When you get past 20 minutes, people tend to say, hey, you know, I got a little extra time. Maybe I'll go down and get that quart of milk at the convenience store and actually put themselves in danger. And so that's a good example of where the physical scientists, the meteorologists, need to get together with the behavioral scientists. So we need to do some of that as well.
Okay, so get out of those silos.
Exactly.
Let's talk.
All right.
All right, well, thank you so much for sitting down with us. We really appreciate
pleasure.
It.
My pleasure. And thank you for your interest in the Marine Technology Society. The last comment I'll make is that we are really working hard to strengthen and build up the footprint of the Marine Technology Society here in Hawaii. And we've got some great folks at UH and at the various industries here and the government labs, and it's really going to be fun to watch how that grows. We had our big conference here in 2001 and 2011. Let's get it back here again in a few years.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Rick Spinrad, former chief scientist at NOAA, who has taken over as the new head of the Marine Technology Society. He's in town for a seminar being held at the NOAA headquarters at Ford Island and at the University of Hawaii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Douglas Trade Shows, serving Hawaii since 1983, featuring the Hawaii Market Merchandise Expos four times a year at the Neil Blaisdell Expo Hall. DouglasTradeShows.com.
I'm Ira Plato. On the next Science Friday, when it's too much to rebuild, is it time to retreat from the coasts?
I actually have been thinking about leaving because of the increased flooding and the effects of climate change here in the Houston area.
Our next Degrees of Change looks at communities that want people to leave their flood-prone homes. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for a native Hawaiian music artist. Born in 1903, she was the youngest of five children, and she was hanai'd to friends of her mother. Her hanai family was not musical and discouraged her interest in singing, but she nonetheless learned to play the ukulele. As a child, she still lay with her hanai family at Honolulu Harbor as passengers arrived via steamship. Musically, she was also known for her ha'i, emphasizing the transition between the singer's lower and falsetto vocal ranges. Radio manager Marion Mulroney discovered her while she sang in a mango tree. Mulroney booked her for a 10-minute set, but listeners flooded the lines, and she sang for a whole hour. She married a Honolulu police detective, and together with siblings formed a singing group. In addition, her wide-ranging career included on-and-off singing gigs with the Royal Hawaiian Band. Later, she had her own radio show. In 1965, she was injured in a car accident causing her to go blind in one eye and walking with a limp. She never fully recovered and developed a heart condition. To pay for her medical bills, Genoa Keawe held a benefit concert in December 1973. She died less than 2 months later. Her musical contributions, though, were not forgotten, and in 1995, she was among the first group to be named the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame. Do you know the name of Hawaii Songbird? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Haleakala Waldorf School, and Honolulu Waldorf School.
This week, Hawaii County stopped accepting most plastics and papers at its recycling centers. Recycling companies used to sell those materials for a profit until China stopped accepting foreign waste in 2017. Hawaii County says its contractor was actually losing money by taking those materials, losses it could no longer sustain. It's a problem facing cities across the country and one that was a major topic of discussion at the 2019 U.S. Conference of Mayors in Honolulu. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was there and spoke with someone who knows something about the global business of recycling. Susan Robinson has worked for the trash and recycling giant Waste Management for 20 years. She believes there is hope for recycling to make a comeback.
So I think really for us, because so much of what we manage is paper, while we've been better able to adapt to the plastic markets without China, without the material moving to China, but almost 60% of what we recycle is cardboard and mixed paper. So we're really relying on new mill capacity in the United States to be able to really, to pick up that slack of what was going to China before. Waste Management's been able to market the material to markets across the globe, moving more into India, to Europe, to Mexico, other Southeast Asian countries. However, really globally, what we really need is more mill capacity to kind of fill in that gap. And we're seeing in the U.S., we're seeing that those plans, about 17 new projects that are planned to come online over the next 2 years, which we think then will fill in that gap, close that gap of time.
So we're talking about the construction of new facilities to take over what China was doing.
We have several new, there are several new facilities that have actually been announced and planned, as well as some existing facilities that are adding more ability to take recycled materials.
Now, is there any difference or divergence within the recycling industry for different materials? Is it easier or harder to do paper versus glass and that kind of thing?
Paper mills are very expensive. They take a lot of time, permitting, cost to build, so that takes a lot more time. I think it's a little bit more, there's more flexibility in other types of plastic in particular. So we see a little bit more conversion of material, plastic, solutions taking place in parts of the country, probably a little quicker. The paper is really the one that takes a little longer to make that investment.
Mayor Margo from El Paso mentioned how much more expensive it is. Like, it was like almost 10 times more expensive to recycle the materials they were collecting versus putting them in the landfill. Will we ever get close to recycling being equal to throwing something in the landfill, or will it always be more expensive?
I think we have not in the past truly accounted for the cost of recycling. There's always been a cost to collect, to process. We've tried to encourage people to recycle, so we haven't talked about the cost, and we've hidden some of that by either subsidizing through garbage or by the commodity value offsetting those costs. Many communities actually use different policy drivers to artificially change that so that the cost of disposal becomes more expensive than the cost of recycling. That helps a lot. I think also we happen to have two other issues. Increasing the quality of the material can make a really big difference in helping to reduce the cost of process as well as then the value. So you kind of get a double bang for the buck when you're processing less contaminated material and you're selling your end product for a higher value because it's cleaner. That's another way that we're going to make probably one of the best things we can do to make an investment into the future, an economically viable recycling future.
How long, what do you think the time horizon is on that, you know, that the market kind of bottomed out 2 years ago when China pulled out and now we're building up capacity? How long do you think it will take before it becomes a little more economically feasible?
We are hoping that when some of these new mills come online within the next year, 1 to 2 years, that we'll start to see more demand for the material. It's really key. We need to be all purchasing materials and encouraging the use of post-consumer content in materials to drive that demand. And as we do that, we're hoping in the next 1 to 2 years to see a return to some of the value of that material.
Who is primarily driving this industry in the United States? Is it towns and cities, municipalities, or are there private actors that are also pushing it as well?
It's all of the above. It's a very disconnected, fragmented market. We're the largest residential recycler in North America. There are a large number of recyclers. A lot of municipalities do the collection. And then single stream recycling tends to be, the facilities themselves tend to be more privately operated, but there are still a lot of recycling facilities in smaller communities across the country.
The Denver mayor, Mayor Hancock, mentioned that a huge portion of recycled materials in his city come from commercial activity, construction in particular. Is that typical? Because I think everybody thinks of, you know, household products as being the main thing.
Yeah, we do think of construction. It's actually categorized a little bit differently. When we look at the municipal waste stream, construction tends to fall outside of that. That data, those statistics. But even when you carve out that construction and demolition, and in some communities, indeed, it is a very large percentage of the material, especially growing communities, even when you carve that out, the commercial sector is larger than the residential sector. And then even within that residential sector, it's only about a third of the material that's actually the traditional recyclables that we're targeting for capture and recycling.
What are the differences in those two streams of material? How are they handled, and what are the challenges that are unique to each one?
They're very different. For one, often the residential stream is collected either by one collector or by a municipality. whereas the commercial sector, often there are multiple different companies collecting, and they actually, in many communities, there's a robust recycling market for that commercial material, especially office buildings where it's a lot of paper, or facilities that have distribution centers with a lot of cardboard. Almost 100% of that material is captured for recycling, that cardboard from large warehouses and distribution centers, because it's really valuable historically, and it's fairly easy to capture. So it's a really different collection system, different infrastructure, different structure, and both have a lot of opportunity to continue to improve.
I had read in after China stopped taking materials that there were some particular materials, I'm thinking of certain types of plastic in particular, that just weren't profitable anymore to recycle, and it didn't make sense for private companies to process them, and they just ended up getting thrown out. How susceptible or vulnerable to that market action is the recycling industry as a whole with all these different products?
Well, I think in particular what you may be referring to are what we call the 3 through 7 mixed plastics. So that was basically the material that China announced that they were going to stop collecting, was mixed bales of a variety of different types of plastics. There were low-grade materials to start with, so when that material lost its home in China, there were some communities that had a very hard time finding markets for it. Now, there are two important points. It makes up about less than 1% of the material that we collect for recycling, and now what we've also are finding of that material, most of it's polypropylene, and we're actually starting to pull that out because markets are developing for it. So we actually are seeing polypropylene growing as a new commodity market.
So it's an ever-evolving industry, it sounds like.
It is all from the beginning of time. When I started in this industry, we were mostly collecting beer bottles and newspapers. Then we moved towards aluminum cans. Then I remember when PET and HDPE started to move into the stream. Then in the 2000s, we saw newspapers start to go away. And we've seen, you know, a complete shift now to lightweight materials. In fact, we talked about, I think it was the mayor of El Paso, that they have less recyclables than they did. Part of it may be that the material weighs a lot less. We actually have to recycle 30% more plastic water bottles because they weigh less just to get the same tonnage number. So it's a shift in the waste stream. Not all of it's bad. We're using less raw materials, but it means that we're constantly evolving what we do and how we do it.
Great, Susan. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Susan Robinson, Senior Director of Sustainability and Policy at Waste Management. You can find more on the changes coming to Hawaii Island's recycling program at hawaiipublicradio.org. Honolulu Civil Beat brings us our regular dose of reality, and reporter Marcel Henri has been tracking all things heart-related. He joins us with the latest. Good morning, Marcel.
Hey, Catherine. We made it to Aloha Friday.
Yes, we have. Hey, so you're focusing on staff changes at Heart.
Yeah, you could say that. this involves Russell Yamanoha. He is he was until recently an information specialist at HART, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, which handles the largest ever public works project in Hawaii. He was a media contact. He dealt a lot with folks like me as we were trying to get information from the agency. And last month, he pleaded guilty to rigging an IBW Local 1260 vote back in 2015 before he joined HART. And this was a Guam-based unit of the union, and it involved Yamanoha and at least three others who traveled to Guam, and they filled out fake ballots and replaced the real ones and destroyed the real ones. And this basically led to a dues increase that likely otherwise would not have passed. And he's agreed to testify now to his former boss at the IBW, Brian Ahakuelo.
Right, and Brian is facing a number of indictments.
Right. They're basically going after the the big fish, frankly. And Russell and several others were indicted, and Russell is now cooperating. Now, it doesn't involve Hart, but, you know, Hart faces its own public image issues and, you know, the costs that have been exploding and going over budget. And it also had received its own three subpoenas back in February. And there's been an unspecified amount of grand jury subpoenas that have gone out to Hart employees and potentially former employees. So Hart is under incredible scrutiny. And even though this doesn't directly relate to Hart, it raised a lot of questions and criticism about whether, you know, Russell should remain at the agency given the overall circumstances.
Right. And I think both you and I were calling Hart to find out what is the status, if there's any change in his employment when the indictments first came down, and we were told no.
Yeah, it's interesting. Back in September, right after Russell had his plea agreement, we met with Andrew Robbins, who's the executive director of Hart, and he said at that point that there was no compelling reason to dismiss Yamanoha and that he's doing a good job at Hart and that they would wait until December for the sentencing to see what happens and make a decision on any action, if any, at that point. So yesterday we did find out that he is in fact no longer at Hart. What's interesting is Robbins would not say whether he had been fired or whether he left of his own accord.
Yeah, it's a little puzzling because from what I understand, what they're just being very tight-lipped about, you know, when he left. And I know they recently made a new hire over there in that office, I believe. I think it was someone with the, Neighborhood Board Commission.
Right. I forget his exact title, but he did move over there, and you know they're doing a lot of public outreach. So you are seeing those things filled. We don't know if there's been any sort of severance agreement or you know similar settlement, something like that with Russell. What it could be, and you know I was talking with Brian Black yesterday with the Civil Beat Law Center. You know, Hart doesn't actually immediately have to disclose whether Russ had been fired or not. Russ could challenge the termination, and then it's only after a 30-day period that Hart is actually compelled and it's mandatory to report what happened.
Now, he hasn't been sentenced yet, though, has he?
He hasn't. That comes in December. And I think if memory serves correctly from the plea agreement, he could face up to a year in jail and monetary fines as well.
Right. I mean, I could see then if he does, let's say, face jail term, he wouldn't be able to report to work. And then, you know, that would be, you know, reason to not keep him on the payroll. But
that would be problematic in terms of doing his job at Hart.
Right, right. So just curious why they're being tight-lipped about details on his departure.
Yeah, you know, you could make the argument that it really serves the public interest to be as transparent and accountable on this as you can.
All right. Well, we'll just keep asking. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henri with today's reality check. To read his full story, go to civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra's season premiere featuring works by Gershwin and Borodin and Schubert's String Quintet in C, October 27th at Kihei Baptist Chapel. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Diana Percy, author of Becoming an Elder, Practicing the Wisdom Arts. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about aging with grace and wisdom.
Sunday morning at 11.
Calling all hooch hounds, teetotalers, and public radio lovers. On Saturday, October 26, Step Back in Time as HPR's Generation Listen transforms our studios into a Prohibition-era speakeasy. Enjoy swinging tunes from DJ David Nala and pianist Buddy Nowhere. Plus poo-poos, libations, and that delicious thrill of breaking the rules. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking for a native Hawaiian music artist known as Hawaii Songbird. Born in 1903, she was the youngest of five children, and she was hanai to Lou and Mary Davis Pan, who were friends of her mother's. Her hanai family was not musical and discouraged her interest in singing, but she nonetheless learned to play the ukulele. As a child, she sold lei with her hanai family at Honolulu Harbor as passengers arrived via steamship. Talking with Kupuna, she heard life stories and experiences that would help her write songs when she was older. They also taught her how to create lyrics with multiple meanings called kaona, which can be found in much of her mele. Radio manager Marion Mulroney discovered her while she sang in a mango tree. Her musical contributions were not forgotten, and in 1995, she was among the first group to be named the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame. Media called her Hawaii Songbird, and her name was Lena Machado. And congratulations to Kiihele from the Big Island. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Countdown to a new music festival on the horizon. A month from now, ANA, All Nippon Airways, takes off with an idea that it hopes will be an annual event. Expect a series of concerts at different venues, some of them free. It will include a nod to our past, and one event will team up with the Mission House's Museum to showcase Monarch's Mele, music from King Kalakaua, in a nod to his upcoming birthday. The festival has classical overtones, and to that end will feature Japan's top violinist, Ryu Gyoto. Goto grabbed the music spotlight at age 7 as a child prodigy. Hawaii's Chris Yick is with the Hawaii Chamber Music Festival. He's an Iolani school graduate attending college on the mainland, but is intimately involved in the planning for this festival.
A few months ago, back in spring, ANA had meetings with all the local music organizations talking about this upcoming festival, and they were asking our opinions on, you know, which ensembles, which artists should we bring, what kind of proposals. And that's how I got involved. And then for my organization, we're going to be teaming up with Iolani School, and we're creating this side-by-side orchestra for Mr. Ryu Goto, who's coming in.
Now that's going to be an awesome concert.
Yeah, I believe so. I'm really excited. He's going to be performing the Vivaldi Four Seasons. So, you know, it's a great way to kick off ANA's big Honolulu Music Week this year. For Ryu, what he's most excited about, obviously, it's the opportunity to perform in Hawaii since he's a big star coming from Japan. But really, he was really excited to have the opportunity to work with the youth musicians at Iolani. And within that, you know, he hopes to, within the rehearsal times and just interacting with the kids, just really sort of develop a relationship, because he's very educational oriented for violin. And I think, you know, it's going to be great because it's going to be a big holiday, like cultural holiday with King Kalakaua. So it's a very meaningful performance, and it will be at the Koihau Church.
So that'll be really a nice intimate space to hear his music.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's going to be paired by some hula works with the dance department of Iolani as well. And then we're going to actually have the Vaughn Williams Fantasia on Thomas Tallis being performed. And it is that piece alone was meant to be performed in a church. So something like Kauai Hau is, you know, perfect.
So you're still attending school and you're involved in all of this and as it's coming to this big crescendo.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's definitely very fulfilling work, I would say. You know, even though I am in school, it's great to see sort of both sides from, and I'm actually in music school as well. So sort of seeing things in the music world from a student's perspective, but now seeing it from a, you know, managerial, artistic, you know, development perspective. It's great to see both sides, and I think they go hand in hand.
You obviously love classic music, but this music festival really covers the gamut.
Yeah, so, you know, the theme this year for the inaugural year is Together in Harmony, and they really, I think ANA, you know, their motto is Inspiration of Japan, and I think, you know, with the new flights, their new routes, and they really want to invest in the community of Hawaii, and I think to their opinion, to their voice, they think music is the universal language. So they think this music festival will really engage local community members and also, you know, visitors who are in town during that sort of, during that time. And, you know, they're catering to all tastes, meaning, you know, the genres. We're going to have pop, classical, contemporary, Hawaiian, opera. And what I'm really thrilled about is how ANA is really engaging the community, not only from the audience perspective, but from a very organizational perspective. So we have, you know, obviously the Hawaii Chamber Music Festival will be involved, Iolani School, Hawaii Youth Symphony will be involved, and the University of Hawaii Orchestra, and of course we have our flagship state orchestra, the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, will be involved.
Okay, and then as far as the pop names, who were you folks able to tap?
Yeah, so, you know, within, we there are two types of concerts. There will be, like, free and ticketed. From the pop side, for the free concerts, we have guitarist, young rising Japanese star Eden Kai, who is a big actor on Terrace House, who will be performing a free concert. But the headliner for the pops, we have Mr. Engelbert Humperdinck, who will be performing at the Blaisdell Hall on Saturday, the evening of November 16th.
Okay, and those you've got to get tickets for, right?
Yes, for Humperdinck, yes, that's correct.
So as far as the inspiration for this festival, I mean, were you a part of then that group that said, hey, let's try this and let's work up a lineup?
Well, yeah. So originally I proposed, you know, bringing Ryu Goto and Eden Kai in the mix, because for me, sort of seeing it from the outside was sort of how can we, you know, engage the local community but also showcase, you know, these international sensations. And then there's a great team involved, and ANA is really supportive of what, you know, what kind of lineup we should produce, and, you know, to cater to everyone's taste. And that's how we came up with the combinations of we should get, you know, Iolani School involved, we should have the Hawaii Symphony involved, and just to showcase, you know, we have a lot of international sensations coming, but it's ANA is really investing in the community by showcasing what the community has to offer already in our own music community.
And so the various venues that you folks are tapping?
Yeah, so you know, we'll have a big opening gala concert at the Neil Blaisdell Hall on Friday, November 15th. And we have two concerts at the Kauai Hau Church. And, of course, Blaisdell will be used throughout that period of time. But, you know, a lot of the free concerts, well, we're talking like downtown Bishop Square, Ritz-Carlton Residences, Waikiki Beach, brand new La'ula Park, the Royal Hawaiian Center, International Marketplace, you know, ANA just really has this plan to fill the city with music, fill Honolulu with music.
And so do they hope to be a number of folks from Japan who will fly over for this concert?
I do think so, actually. I'm told, you know, the artist lineup is not only popular within our local community, but it's very popular in Japan, of course, outside of Hawaii. And especially someone like Mr. Ryu Goto, who is, you know, he's very well known in Japan. Very incredible musician. I think, you know, stuff like him being sort of the symbolic identity, if you may say, because he is an American born and raised Japanese violinist, but, you know, he travels between America and Japan performing a lot. And for him to sort of come to Hawaii now, it's sort of just mere, you know, putting that relationship together for, you know, through music.
So how is this going to work? Because you're still completing your college work, and you're going to break away from this concert.
Well, you know, it's a team effort. Obviously, like, I'm still in school, so there are other great promoters involved. ANA is obviously leading the way throughout all of this. I think, you know, we have a great dynamic between all the creative people and the logistics people, and we're going to put on a really great festival. And I think, yeah, I will be here. You know, I got excused from school to be able to come for this. And I'm looking forward to, you know, presenting not only my alma mater, but just a really big name for Hawaii in general.
And so what do you want to do when you graduate?
You know, that's an excellent question. Right now I'm on track to be a double bass performance major. I would love to perform in a symphony orchestra, you know, perform chamber music, but I sort of want a hybrid career that would allow me to perform and also, you know, coordinate and promote big classical music events.
Right, and you've got a taste of it here.
Yeah, it's been great. It's a great opportunity, not only for my organization, but for me personally, just to be able to, you know, grow and learn under some of the most, you know, well-respected promoters on the team, and just to be able to interact with such great musicians. And it's great because, you know, obviously, my perspective at least, I see them as incredible artists on the stage. But of course, within, like, even just putting this festival together off the stage, you create some of these great friendships, relationships, and you really see how you can interact with these, you know, musicians off the, like, outside of music.
Right. Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. The very first music festival.
Yeah. I think ANA, obviously this year will be 3 days from November 15th through 17th, and they have ambitions to, you know, go beyond just this year. They want to make this an annual event. And, you know, we're going to kick off with Together in Harmony, and then the intention is with each year it'll grow into a much larger, much, you know, even higher quality lineup of artistry, and of course while engaging the community, whether that's through educational opportunities or, you know, just outreach or just using our local ensembles.
That was Chris Yick talking about the first ever ANA Music Festival. It kicks off November 15th. And hey, here's a sample of another headliner, Engelbert Humperdinck.